We are starting the book of John today, the first chapter. I hope you've had an opportunity to read it. And before we start, we have a new person. What was your name again?
Terry Brazil.
I'm old and I can't hear well, so you know I apologize about that. Anyway, welcome. Glad to have you.
Ben's sure coming
to drop by. Okay, well, Ben was here yesterday. So anyway,
he's specifically coming Thursday.
Yeah, this is a real slow group.
And I'm going to move our mouse when we
inside. All right, everybody, let's turn to John 1. Hopefully, you're maybe already there. Hopefully, you've had a chance to read it, maybe even more than once.
I'm good right now.
Okay. All right. John 1. Many people believe that this is one of this first chapter is just very, very significant, and I'm in agreement. But let me just make a couple of comments about the book of John, just for you guys. As you probably noticed, that you don't have the Christmas story narrative in John like you do Matthew and you do in Luke. And what else makes it unusual is 21 chapters, and yet almost half the book, the last 10 chapters, really describe the last week, maybe 10 days, maybe 2 weeks of Jesus' life. And the last 8 chapters focus on his time with his disciples right before he's going to be taken. You know, you have the Last Supper. And then you see where he's taken into custody. You see his words, the conversation he has with, if you want to call it a conversation, with Pilate, which is very interesting. Then, you know, you have the crucifixion and then the resurrection. And then you have, in like the last chapter, you have this really, I guess you call it a great conversation that the risen Christ has with his disciples, particularly with Peter. And what you'll find is that John is not really a history of Jesus' ministry. You know, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, more of it kind of goes in chronological order, the history or the time where Jesus spent in ministry, where that's what you don't see that in John. John is more of a powerful argument for the incarnation. In fact, it's more of a kind of a conclusive demonstration that Jesus was and is not only the Son of God, but the very source of eternal life. And so, if you ever have a skeptic that's searching and is saying, where should I read in the Bible? Where should I start? Point them to John. In fact, I know a guy who kind of does something, what we do, you know, we do an investigative study. He does something similar, but he basically has them read and they study and talk about the first 7 chapters of the book of John. If you remember Francis Collins, who I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, the famous scientist, who recognized, basically he was an atheist, but after he was asked by this little old lady about his faith and what he really believed, he said, I realized that here as a scientist, everything that I believed in science came from my research and studying the evidence and coming to conclusions. He said, when it came to issues of faith in God, he said, I had not looked at any evidence, and yet I had drawn these conclusions. And he said, therefore, if I was going to have any intellectual integrity as an atheist, I needed to do some research. And so he talked to this man who was a minister, and the man pointed him to C.S. Lewis's work. And he said, I also suggest you read the book of John. And he said, that was basically when, and he said, I was stunned at what I read. And that was kind of the path that he went down to ultimately becoming a Christian. You see, what you see in every chapter of John is this emphasis placed on Jesus' deity. For example, only in John do you see all of what I just call them this, these great I am statements. You know, he says, I am the bread of life. Now, I want to ask you something. What would you guys do if I stood up here and said, guys, I got something to tell you. I am the bread of life. It would just be a matter of time before you guys start running out the door saying, you know, this guy's lost it. But he says, I am the bread of life. I am the light of the world. I mean, what an audacious statement. I'm not just one of the many lights that are out there. He says, I am the light. Then he says, I am the door. I'm the door that you go through for life everlasting. I'm the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. In John 14, he says, I am the way, the truth, the life. And then in John 15, he says, I am the true vine. You know, guys, anybody making these kind of statements would be considered either a lunatic, or if it was true, you'd have to be God himself. Only Jesus could make those kind of statements. Now, the first 14 verses are really significant, and I'm going to make a couple of comments. And then at the very end of the study, I'm going to come back and share with you something that I think is just incredibly powerful about what Jesus is saying, or what John is saying in these first 14 verses. But what you do see, again, is that John clearly doesn't concern himself with what happened on that first Christmas, the details of it. Instead, he's focused on the significance of it. And what is the significance? That the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. Jesus, John is telling us, is the ultimate revelation of God and who God is. It's like I may have told you that when my oldest son was about 9, he asked me, he said, Dad, this is just out of the blue, he said, why do you believe in God? And I gave him all kind of reasons. I said, there are a lot of very good, rational, logical reasons to believe in God. I said, but for me, ultimately, I believe in God because of Jesus, the Word becoming flesh, dwelling among us. As one commentator said, Jesus is the supreme revelation of God. If we are to know God, neither rationalism nor irrational mysticism will suffice. God chose to make himself known, finally and ultimately, in a real historical person. Now, as you read John 1, he's talking about really kind of how God came into the world. And then look at verse 12. Somebody read verse 12 for us, if they would. Donnie Patton, you want
to
read it?
Yet to all who received him, to those who believed in his name, he gave the right to become children of God.
What's that about? I mean, John is giving this great announcement, this great proclamation. And then he's saying what? In order to really integrate this into your life, for it to be real, for it to be legitimate, for you to be a Christian, you have to receive him. Now, what does that mean? Receive him.
It's still optional.
Do what?
It's still optional.
It is. It is. And if you think about it, it's kind of like this, to understand it. Four times the Apostle Paul says that Christ gave himself to us when he went to the cross. He gave himself to us. And if somebody gives you something, you receive it. You have to receive it into your life. And as we said before, the best way to picture this is in a marriage, in a wedding. Remember, Jesus refers to himself four different times as what? The bridegroom. Which is weird, kind of, isn't it? Notice he doesn't say, I'm the husband. He's referred to as the bridegroom. And that's the language of marriage. And that's why in the traditional wedding service that usually, I think, are used by all denominations, the traditional wedding service, it says this, that marriage is a picture of the mystical union that exists between Christ and His church. And therefore, the marriage is a picture of two people entering into a holy covenant relationship. And next time you go to a wedding, listen to the vows. And it's significant. You know, they start off looking at the minister. And usually then when they do their vows, they turn and they face each other. And they usually hold each other's hands like this. And if you listen, what they're doing is they're giving themselves to each other. And they give themselves and you receive them. And Jesus says, I've given myself to you. Will you receive me into your life? And then this is the most powerful thing. And because when you do, it says you then have the right to become children of God. In other words, we're adopted into His family. And John obviously thinks this is very important because in the book of 1 John, he says, how great is the love the Father has lavished on us that we should be called children of God. And then he says, and that is what we are, children of God. Comments or questions on anything I've said? Anybody? All right, we're going to come back to these first few verses at the very end, but let's jump to verse 15. Let's talk a little bit about John the Baptist. What was John's role? What was his purpose?
He was telling everybody Jesus was coming.
Yeah, he was basically coming to prepare the way, as he put it. In fact, John's life is foretold back in Isaiah, which was written like 700 years before that. And in Isaiah 40, in verse 3, it says, a voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Then in verse 5 it says, because then the glory of the Lord is going to be revealed, and all flesh will see it together. John had a clear role to play. And that is to prepare the way of the Lord. And then, you know, he comes along, and I don't know if you realize it, he has this huge following. I mean, people go out and, you know, some people think it's because he was so weird. But really, there were several reasons that they came out to hear him. And, you know, one of the things that happens is that he upsets the religious establishment because he was so popular. You know, there's nothing that upsets the religious establishment more than somebody getting popular. Now, let me give you an example. Here in Birmingham, Church of the Highlands. I don't know what you know about it. Dan goes there. Somebody, Bo, you go there? I went. My son goes to all. He goes the one down in Auburn. And he for his birthday, which was back in December, he said I wanted the whole family to go with me to Church of the Highlands. We went. It was great. But a lot of people don't like it. One guy was telling me his minister doesn't like it at all, and I said why? He said because so many of our members have left to go to Church of the Highlands. I said it's kind of like he thinks he owns these people. Man, what are you doing? And I don't mean, I promise, this is not meant to be critical, but that's what happens. When something becomes real popular, a lot of people just don't like it. That's what happened with John. The religious establishment hated him. And,
What would the time frame, what would the scholars say, the time space between when Isaiah supposedly prophesied John?
I want to say it's like 700 and some change, 700 years and some change. So, But it's a long time. It's a long time.
You've had a lot of books for 700 years.
But let's look at the two things that you see about John in these verses. One, you see that John has a real humility about him. Look at verse 15. In the New American, it says, John testified about him and cried out, saying, "This was he of whom I said, he who comes after me has a much higher rank than I do, for he existed before me." So he said, you know, you don't see John as this real arrogant person. He says, the one that I'm, you know, he has a much higher rank than I do. He's much more important than I. And then go down to verse 27, where it says, "It is he who comes after me, the thong of whose sandal I'm not worthy to untie." You know, back then, only a slave could be required to untie somebody's sandals, take their shoes off, and wash their nasty feet. That's what slaves did. And John's saying, I'm not even worthy to be a slave when it comes to the Messiah. And do you remember, we're going to see it, it's in chapter 3, which we'll get to in 2 weeks. But once Jesus begins his ministry, all of John's followers begin to peel off and start coming and hearing Jesus. And two of John's disciples go to John and say, "John, what are we going to do? You're losing all your followers." You remember what John says? What does he say? He must increase. He being Jesus, must increase. And I must decrease. In other words, he says, my role is done. You know, John could have said, you know, I've got a great following here. Let's see what we can do. Let's see how great we can get, how big we can be. No, he says, my work is done. I must decrease. You know, I give a message. I teach a message on leadership. I did it this last Friday afternoon to a nonprofit here in Birmingham, spoke to their staff. And I really believe this with all my heart, the most significant and important quality of a leader is humility. And John possessed it. You remember we've talked about, it's been a while since we've talked about humility, but remember true humility? It comes from Jim Collins in his book, Good to Great. As he describes these level five leaders, he says, true humility requires a paradoxical blend of personal humility and yet also fearlessness on your part. He says you can't have one without the other. Too many people think humility is just to be meek and mild and kind of mousy and kind of other. It's not. John the Baptist was truly humble. You see his humility, but you see his fearlessness in his preaching and when he goes before Herod and calls him a hypocrite and a fox, and just all these different things, because Herod had stolen his brother's wife. And John would not back down, and eventually cost him his life. And so, you see in John the Baptist this real humility. And you see, you know, that's... And let me just stop here. Because a guy yesterday said, well, how do we become more humble? And he was really, I mean, very sincere. And I said, it's not, you can't just flip a switch and say, all right, I'm humble now. It's something, guys, that you have to cultivate in your life. And the Bible says that we cultivate it by learning how to, and this phrase is used in both the Old and New Testament. You remember the phrase? Humble yourselves. Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God. And remember that we said there may be more than four, but there are four clear ways that you can humble yourself. One is through thanksgiving and having a real grateful heart. Humble people are grateful people. The second comes from Luke 18, the parable of the Pharisee and the tax collector. You remember that you got the arrogant, self-righteous Pharisee and the tax collector, he says, who couldn't even lift up his head and beat his breast and said, God, have mercy on me, the sinner. Jesus says, in that parable, he says, that's the way you humble yourself. To confess your sin before God. A third way you humble yourself, 2 Corinthians 12, 5-7, where Paul talks about when I'm weak, that's when I'm strong. And he talks about basically our willingness to go before God regularly and just declare how weak we are and we need his strength. You see that in David's life. Psalm 30:10. Hear, O Lord, be gracious to me. O Lord, be my helper. When you declare, Lord, I'm needy. I need you. You're humbling yourself. Now the fourth is real hard for most men. It's what Dallas Willard calls the discipline of secrecy. He says, whenever you do anything great, whenever you do anything noteworthy, he says, keep it a secret. You know, we think we got to tell the world how great we are. We love to drop names. We love to drop accomplishments. He says, keep it a secret. And the way, you know, I love the way he puts it. He says, just what Jesus said. It's from Sermon on the Mount. He says, when you give to the poor, don't let everybody know you're doing it. Don't let the left hand know what the right hand is doing it. Keep it a secret. But God knows. And then I love what he says. He says, the best way to practice the discipline of secrecy is to put your public relations department in the hands of God. If he wants it to be known, it'll be known. People will find out. But let him do it and not you. You know, in Matthew 23:5, he says, this is the problem with the Pharisees. Listen to what it says. He says, they do all of their deeds to be noticed by men. And Jesus detested that. So that's the way you humble yourself. Those are four ways you humble yourself. And in humility, there's strength. Because God says, I only give my grace and my strength and my power to humble people. So people were attracted to the true humility in John. And they saw the strength that came out of his life. But then he also shows great reverence for the Messiah. He speaks of him. And, you know, he says, I'm unworthy to tie his sandals. His rank is so much greater than mine. But what do we learn about the Messiah in verse 29 of John 1? Look at verse 29.
Takes away the sins.
Yeah, and he calls him what? He recognizes him as what?
The Lamb of God.
Sacrificial.
Think about it. John is the only one, he was not only the first person, I think, but he was the only one that really got this. Because they considered, they were expecting the Messiah to be a conquering Messiah, to be a worldly king. And that's what the disciples thought. That's why they're always arguing who's going to sit on his left and his right. That he was going to overcome the Roman Empire and set up a worldly kingdom. But John saw, no, that's not the case. He is a king. But he's a king that came to hang on a cross, which is not what you would expect. But John got this. And you know, Jesus had this paradoxical blend of humility and fearlessness. And that's why I love that. You know what he's called in the book of Revelation? A lion and a lamb. But the lamb was significant because the lamb was basically was slain so that we don't have to be. He is the substitute. Let me say one other thing about John, and then I'll stop and see if you have any comments or questions. One of the things that strikes me most about John the Baptist is that he recognized this, guys. He recognized he had a role to play in what God was trying to do in the world. I guess you could say he had a significant role. But he had a role to play. And he played it. As I said earlier, he didn't say, all right, I'm going to do more. I'm going to go out and have a bigger impact. This is what I'm called to do, to prepare the way of God for God. It had nothing to do with him. He recognized that at a certain point, He must decrease as Jesus increases. The question that we need to ask ourselves is, what is God's role for me in the world? Does he have a role? Does he have something he wants to do in and through me? What do you think? We know that he does. You know how we know he does? Ephesians 2:10. We are God's workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which he prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. Now, whenever I was talking about this, people begin to wonder, well, what does this mean to me? Does this mean I need to quit doing what I'm doing and go out and do some great thing for God? I would refer you back, two thoughts. I would refer you back to the book of Mark. We talked about this back in the fall. You remember when Jesus orders those demons out of that crazy guy who was demon-possessed, and they go into the swine, and the people come and they were afraid of him after what they heard had happened. And there's the man sitting there in his right mind. And you remember, what does he say to Jesus? Do you remember?
Thanks.
He says, thanks. And then what does he say?
I want to go with you.
I'm going with you. I'm signing up. Wherever you want me to go, I am going. And what did Jesus say? No. Go back to your home. Go back to your community. Go back to your sphere of influence and tell them what great things God has done in your life. And I feel like we all have a sphere of influence of some kind. And God wants to use us right here, right now. The question we've got to ask ourselves is, Lord, what would you have me to do? You know, I've suggested, pray that God would open up doors. But this leads us into, I think is a good leader, is a good segue into verses 35 to 51. But before we do, what are your comments or questions? Anybody? Bill?
Simmons, I don't know if it does it in it, but Jesus sought out John. So did John spend his life wandering around? Because it's clear he knew that Jesus was coming.
That's a really good question.
So,
good point.
I mean, it says in every one of the accounts that Jesus came to him and said,
he came to get baptized. Yeah.
So prior to that, who was he baptizing the people to? And was John's role all the way back from Isaiah, all the way forward, to try to wait until that person came to him?
Well, in doing my preparation for this, of course, I think you probably know, but maybe not, that John and Jesus were cousins. You know, their mothers, Elizabeth and Mary. So they knew of each other. You know, the question is, and a lot of scholars don't think that John recognized that Jesus was the Messiah. Because, you know, Jesus was a carpenter in Nazareth. And, you know, I always get a big kick out of this is when he first announces he's getting ready to start his ministry, it's not in John, it's in one of the other Gospels, he stands up, he's in Nazareth, he's in his hometown, he reads this prophecy of the Messiah, he shuts the book, and sits down, and the people all look, and he says, this prophecy is fulfilled today in this reading. In other words, I'm the man. And they all look at each other like, they said, isn't that Joseph's son? It's like, they weren't even sure who he was. He was just so out of the limelight until now. And so, Billy, a lot of people think that John didn't realize it until Jesus came to get baptized, and he sees the heavens open up, the doves, and he says,
watched it. Yeah, baptized.
Yeah. So
his mission was, wasn't it that he was expecting some sort of cataclysmic event that was, you know, semi-Jew in background,
no.
And then suddenly
yeah.
It came to him as no. Jesus.
I think you just nailed it. I think that's correct. Anybody else? All right. In verse 35, Jesus begins his public ministry, and we start by seeing how Jesus meets the first disciple, and there's a key phrase that you see. It's in 39, and then it's down in It's down in,
Forty-six.
And what's that phrase?
Come and see.
Come and see.
It's in 50 also.
Come and see. Is it in 50?
You will see greater things than that.
Yeah. Notice in 39, Jesus does not demand that they believe. Instead, he just says, come and see. Just come and see what I say. See what I do. And then Philip comes to Nathanael and says, I found the Messiah, Jesus of Nazareth. And of course, what does Nathanael say?
Nobody from Nazareth.
Yeah, wait, what are you, Nazareth? What good comes out of that podunk place? You see, what most people don't realize is you had this vast Roman Empire and all its glamour and glory. But this area called Palestine, which was the Middle East, was considered kind of the armpit of the Roman Empire, a lot of desert. And in Palestine, there's a region called Galilee, which was just kind of desolate. And in Galilee, there's this little tiny town called Nazareth. There's just a podunk place. And as someone pointed out to me, a lot of people thought that the Messiah would come from Bethlehem because that's where he's going to be born. And we're told that in the Old Testament. But remember, out of fear of Herod for killing all the babies, they fled and moved to Nazareth, where he was a carpenter for 30 years. I think about this. This is really in my notes, but this is something interesting to think about as we talk about Nazareth. Let's assume that God said, okay, you're going to have a child, and I'm going to let you kind of call the shots, and I'll let you create whatever life you want for him, but I want him to have an influence on the world. What kind of life would you picture? Well, first you'd want a kid that probably is great looking, that everybody looks at and says, wow, and a magnetic personality. And you might say, well, I'd probably put him in Washington, D.C., and he'd be President of the United States, or a U.S. Senator, or a Supreme Court Justice. Or you'd stick him in New York, and he'd be some multi-billionaire businessman. Or some would say he needs to be a great athlete, or he needs to be, or she needs to be a rock star, maybe. Think about how rock stars have influence. Or actor or actresses who think they have a lot of influence. Think about it, guys. God could have done this with Jesus. He could have done anything he wanted. He could have, why didn't he send him into a wealthy Roman household where he becomes a Caesar? And what does God do? He sticks him in this little place called Nazareth. And you know, Jesus never traveled more than like 30 miles from Nazareth. And yet, his life of humility changed the world. You see, he didn't impact the world through power. He did it through a humble life. Now, I believe, guys, that our great responsibility as Christians is not to ram Jesus down people's throats. But I think we are called to invite them. Come and see. Check this out. That's kind of the approach that we've taken at the center. We don't have altar calls when we have events. We invite people to go through the investigative study. Years ago, I heard Tim Keller give a sermon on these verses in John 1. And he points out that John the Baptist leads Andrew and this other person who we're not told who he is, leads them and points them to Jesus. And then Andrew, who was one of the 12, come and introduces his brother Peter to Jesus. And then Philip, as we read here, who was one of the 12, introduces Nathanael to Jesus. And from this, Keller says, So what you really have here is a very important point. There are exceptions, he says, but the rule is in general that the way to find Jesus, the way to really come and see Jesus, the way to really know him personally is almost always through some friend. You're not going to find Jesus unless you've already found a, unless you've already been found by a friend who has already found Jesus himself. And then he's given this, you know, he's got this huge congregation in New York. And it's all often, just, I think, apparently just packed. And people bring their friends. There are a lot of people in the congregation who aren't Christians. And Keller knows this, and he says, let me give you a warning. 9 times out of 10, you're really not going to be able to really process what you're hearing unless you've got some friends that know Christ. He says, if Christianity was a philosophy by which you saved yourself, then maybe the main way you would really come to Christ is through some great teacher. But since Christianity is an encounter with a person, the main way you'll see in the Bible over and over again is that you really find Christ through friends. And I believe this is true. It was true in my life. I don't know about you, but it was true in my life. And I would say that if it's not a friend, it might be a parent. Because that's what a parent is, kind of like a friend, or they can be. But I want to ask you this, guys, not trying to make you feel bad, but how many of your friends, people in your sphere of influence, people that you know that don't know Jesus, how many of them have you invited to come and see? Because let's be honest, if we haven't done that, what kind of friend are we? If this is that important, if this is that crucial, we need to invite them to come and see. You know, almost everybody that comes through the investigative study here, bar none, is because a friend has invited them to one of our BCC events, or they drag them in here. I've got two right now. One guy, really bless his heart, has brought his 76-year-old father to meet with me. And then there's another guy I'm getting ready to start with where two of his friends are they're tag teaming to get him here because his life's in the ditch. But it's friends. It's people that care about you. And so we're called to invite them to come and see. It's a responsibility, I believe, that we have. Now, I'm going to close by going back to the first couple of verses, but before I do, anybody have a comment on this?
What if we run out of non-Christian friends?
Well, then you need to go make some new ones. You need to go out there and make some new friends. That's what you need to do.
I tell you, my sphere of friends, I don't know. I'm sitting there thinking, I don't have, unless they're Jews, I don't have any friends that really aren't Christians.
Well, maybe they're, you know, you can find all different types of folks that, I mean, are they really walking with God? Are they really, are they just church going people? I mean, you know, that's what I find is that so often in the South that we got, you know, we assume, okay, they go to church and they're okay. Well, that's not the case. So, but anyway, you know, you look around, I think you'll find them. They're there. You just got to think hard. Next time you go to a cocktail party, look around. I bet you'll find some.
Come on, Billy. See who's outside smoking.
Yeah, those are outside smoking. Yeah.
Yeah. I watch it all in football. Yeah.
All right, I want to close by going back. Everybody, John 1 still? Go to the first verse. This is really fun. Guys, what I'm here to tell you, we got 10 minutes left. What I'm here to tell you is worth you coming today for. All right? In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And then down in 14 it says, and the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. That word, is the Greek word logos. And in just its general, everyday use in the Greek language, it means a statement of fact, or it's truth. So in the beginning was the truth, the logos. But that word logos was also used by the Greeks in philosophy. And it had a different meaning, a secondary meaning that they used. It was used a lot. And does anybody remember what that word was, what that definition was that was used? Anybody remember?
Was it logic? Was it wisdom?
It's where we get the word logic from,
just
logos.
In your blog.
Huh?
Just in your blog, wasn't it?
It's the reason for life. That's what they used it for. They said that basically, if you take anything and if you don't honor its logos, if you don't honor its design, if you don't honor its reason for existence, you'll never be whole and complete. You don't find out what that is. What is the reason for life? Now, I first heard this in a sermon that Keller preached in 1994. But I used it in my book, The True Measure of a Man. And it's very powerful. I want you to listen to it. These are Keller's words. The Greeks said, if when you find the reason for life, or when you find the purpose for an object, that's how it reaches its potential. And it reaches its wholeness and its potentiality. He says, if we find out the reason why we were created, why we were designed, and if we conform to that and honor that, we'll find true freedom in life. We will reach our potential. He says, this is the problem, though, with the Greeks. The Greek philosophers went back and forth for numbers of years trying to say, this is the reason for life. No, this is the reason for life. And he said by the time Jesus came along, the Greek philosophical schools had gone into utter despair. They couldn't agree. And what happened was that basically people started to say, there is no reason for life. There is no logos. And that's kind of where we are today. There is no grand purpose for life. Life is meaningless because there is no God who put us here. And therefore, we're just a bunch of chemicals that became people through the law of natural selection. Dan.
Well, what I was going to say is was John's target audience the Greeks primarily, do you think, since that was their sort of philosophical...
I don't know. It was written in the Greek, and it was written in the Greek language, probably 30 or 40 years after. Yeah.
Mars Hill and Rome,
yeah. Yeah. And so they initially targeted Jews. In fact, Paul, would go into cities and go to the synagogues and it said reason with people through the scriptures. But they went after the Gentiles, the learned people, by going into Greece, Paul died in Rome, seeking to win the Romans to Christ. But Keller says, once they got to a point where they said there is no reason for life, he said it began to sift down into the culture. Because you see, when there's no reason for life, when everything is meaningless, the culture begins to fall apart. Because you begin to say there is no right or wrong. Why should I care about people? They're just a bunch of chemicals. And then he says, and then along comes John. And John drops this unbelievable bombshell. Because he says there is a logos. There is a design. There is a designer. The logos has come. He says, I can show you what the reason for life is, but it's not an abstract philosophical principle. It's a person. That's what C.S. Lewis, he said, I was searching for spiritual truth. I thought I was about to get my hands on it, and I realized that spiritual truth is not a law or principle. It's a person, Jesus. And Keller says, the designer has punched a hole in the roof of the world and he has descended down into it in the person of Christ. And then he says this, listen to this, guys. You were built, all of us, you were built not just to honor some philosophical principle or follow some law. You were built to know and love this divine person, Jesus. And when you know him and you serve him and you love him, when you find out what he built you for and you comply with it and you submit yourself to it, or excuse me, you submit yourself to him, that's when you find out who you really are. And you become the person you were meant to be. And that's why I love when I read this, to go back in John and make this substitute when you read it. In the beginning was the reason for life. And the reason for life was with God. And the reason for life was God. And the reason for life became flesh and dwelt among us. I think Paul says it best in Colossians chapter 2, verses 9 and 10. And it really says it, it's in the New American Standard. It says it best, in my opinion. He says, "For in him, Jesus, all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form. And in him, you have been made complete." Guys, John is telling us that Jesus is the reason for life, and in him, we are made complete.